September 20th, the news of Europe. At this time, and each evening at 6:45 Eastern Daylight Time, Columbia calls in its correspondents abroad for direct reports from the European capitals. Today we'll hear from Eric Severide in London, our correspondent in Berlin, and a report on developments in the nation's capital by Albert Warner. But while we're waiting for the shortwave report of Mr. Severide, here's the news from other points. In Rome, Germany's foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, will have another talk today with Mussolini. The pair had a first discussion yesterday, but so far there is no information as to what they discussed. Rome newspapers said that in talks between von Ribbentrop and Italy's own foreign minister, Count Ciano, southeastern Europe was a chief subject. Meanwhile, a communique in Rome says that British planes have staged intensive raids on major Italian bases in North Africa, but adds that in counterattack, the Italian planes sank a British steamer and a submarine. In Cairo, the British say that no major engagement has yet taken place with the Italians, but that British tanks are causing sharp losses in the ranks of Italian mechanized forces. In the Far East, new tensions cropped up. Japan has made sudden and unexplained demands on French Indochina for bases which geographically have no importance in the war with China. There are reports that the French government will refuse these demands. And now for the report of Eric Severide in the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is London. The sirens have gone only once so far this morning, and I haven't heard yet any bombs or shooting. Some fighters were up over the city for a time, and we've just been informed by the ministry that German raiders were driven back before they reached the city. We had pretty bad weather over London most of the night, so we didn't take as heavy a bombing as we usually get. It was bad weather down on the channel also, so the invasion ships were idle, while the RAF gave them another very severe punishing with high explosive. Reports from Dover now say the rough weather there shows some signs of getting worse in the next few days. That's about all that can be said of the expected invasion, of which Britishers talk less and less as the days go by. One thing is certain, if the Germans don't come, many British Army officers are going to be very disappointed men. They are sure they could beat it, and fairly sure that if they did, Hitler would go down. The Air Ministry communique just issued, reported that RAF bombers successfully attacked communications in Germany, including the Dortmund-Ems Canal, besides several ports and aerodromes in enemy-occupied territory. We haven't got the whole picture yet of last night's raids over London. There were fewer planes and longer intervals between shelling from the ground. But as usual, the all-clear did not sound until dawn. I heard about 5 high explosives in my neighborhood, and a number of incendiaries were whishing past at intervals. They sound like a branch falling to soft ground. One landed on the roof opposite my bedroom window and made no sound at all when it landed. Unless they hit highly inflammable material, they're quite easy to put out. It took just 3 buckets of water for this one with a hand pump and 1 bucket of sand. This bomb was lodged in those sloping roof tiles. When we could pick it up, it turned out to be just a thin cylinder about 1.5 feet long and 2 inches wide. Those bombs, I think, were dropped in clusters. 2 landed in the street, 1 in my courtyard, another on a second apartment house, and 2 or 3 one street away. And the difficulty about these light fire bombs is that very often people, who are mostly underground anyway, don't hear them fall. And while they may be gazing at one fire across, another is secretly building up behind them. So far as I can see this morning, all fires in London are now out. At least one of the raiders was brought down last night in Surrey, and it crashed on a housetop next to a hospital. As it came screaming down in the darkness, one of the crew bailed out and was immediately captured. An anti-aircraft shell had made a direct hit on the plane. One factory in the East End was set on fire, and that was about the most important damage of the night. In the North End of London, a high-explosive bomb landed squarely on the emergency escape door of a public shelter, and a number of sleeping persons were instantly killed. It's reported this morning that the London raiders last night came in from a new direction, the northwest, and it was obvious that they were flying very low. There was a searchlight barrage from central London, and we're told night fighters went up for a time. One hospital in Essex was set on fire by an incendiary. Another bomb started small fires in the Surrey woods, which were much too wet last night to burn very readily. One report says a raider machine gun streets in a northwest suburb. Every morning now, we hear a time bomb going off somewhere around the West End. One exploded 80 yards away from the Duke of Kent yesterday when he was sitting in his car, on which the dirt and rubble descended, but he wasn't hurt. Every day, trucks speed through the streets carrying a time bomb to the open country. I know a traffic policeman near my house who stopped one of those trucks on its perilous errand. He's a big policeman who learned how to silence even the toughest truck drivers years ago with a few well-chosen words. But he tells me now that he has lost all confidence in himself after that experience, and if it weren't for the war, he'd think about retiring to the country. I return you now to CBS New York.
That was London. Here in New York, a dispatch from Honolulu. Admiral James O. Richardson, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, will leave for the United States Monday in the battleship New Mexico, it was understood today. And the battleship Idaho and several other ships were expected to leave also. And next, the report from the German capital. Go ahead, Berlin.
This is Berlin. Again last night, we had no air raid here. Whether the British bombers attacked other places in Germany last evening has not yet been made known. But they did not visit Berlin, though it was a fairly clear moonlight night, one of those nights when there's nothing you can do to hide a great city from enemy airmen. Everyone I know in Berlin has now caught up with a sleep. For about a fortnight, the British did come over almost every night, and we did lose sleep. But there had been no alarm since Sunday, so everyone is feeling normal again. 2 weeks ago, the chief air warden suggested that the population of Berlin set their alarm clocks for around midnight. Then when the bombers arrived and you had to make for the cellar, you didn't feel as bad as when the screaming siren suddenly awakened you and you had to hurry or the British would blow over your rooftop. But the last few days, as one evening after another has passed peacefully, most people, I think, have given up the idea of that midnight alarm clock and have simply slept the night through. The German press this morning is still full of indignant headlines and articles against the British for the bombing of the children's hospital at Beto night before last, when 9 children were killed and 12 injured. The official party newspaper, the Frankfurter Beobachter, has this banner headline this morning: "We will pay back without pity." The Beirut am Mittag carries this front page headline this morning: "It will be mercilessly revenged. Churchill's night of murder at Beto was carefully planned." This paper, in an editorial, calls the British flyers barbarians and their deed a shameful act of murder, and warns that the reprisal of the German Air Force will be a hard one. The Somfortblatt remarks this morning that it is well known that there are many more important objectives in the West End shopping district of London. It says, quote, "The shopping district of London's West End, in which, as is well known, there are many more important objectives, has been continually hit with bombs. A bomb crashed through several stories of a West London hotel," unquote. The German radio this morning says that H.R. Knickerbocker, whom it calls the notorious German hater, had to report from London that the English were gradually losing their cheerfulness as a result of the German bombings. I guess I'll have to refer you to Rome for concrete news of the results of Herr von Ribbentrop's visit. We have no concrete news of it here. But the Berlin press does lift the veil enough this morning to indicate that 2 subjects were paramount in the talks. The Frankfurter Beobachter, for instance, tells us that the talks were mainly concerned with discussing the problems which will arise in Europe and Africa after Great Britain is beaten, and also the reconstruction of what it terms the new order, which the Axis powers plan on setting up. The Frankfurter Beobachter also tells us, in connection with Ribbentrop's talks with Mussolini, that the attitude of the Spanish people in the decisive phase of the struggle with England amounts to a Spanish declaration of solidarity with the Axis powers. News of last night's German air attacks is scanty here this morning. We're told that London was again bombed, and that German attacks were also made on armament factories and industrial works in southern and central Britain last night. This is Bruno Sharon Blaine. I return you now to CBS in New York.
That was William L. Shirer in Berlin. And now, the report of Albert L. Warner in our nation's capital. We take you now to Washington.
There is now reaching the point of decision within the administration, the transfer of some 40 flying fortresses to Great Britain. The wholesale German bombing of London and the destruction of civilian lives and property have given momentum to the proposal. There's plenty of indication here that War Department opinion already has been sounded out, and that the National Defense Commission has been consulted, and the potential reaction of isolationists in Congress taken into account. At present, the Army has on hand, or immediately available, 50 to 75 of these huge bombing planes. The flying fortresses can travel some 4,000 miles with a good-sized load. Their speed in the original models was 250 miles per hour. Now it's been brought up to over 300 miles an hour. There's no doubt of their value to the British Air Force. They could leave Newfoundland one evening and be on British soil the next. They could range the whole extent of Germany, striking even at arms factories in Czechoslovakia. But it takes 2 years to build a flying fortress. Some officers in the War Department have raised the question of whether it would be wise from the standpoint of our own defense to send these planes to Britain. The old issue arises, and the same answer which has been made on previous occasions is again set forth. Namely, that the maintenance of British sea and air strength forms the best initial protection to the United States. Several administration senators already have taken the lead in publicly supporting the transfer of flying fortresses. Now the assistant Republican leader of the Senate, Warren Austin, indicates his sympathy. He tells me there are two questions to be answered. Would those airplanes serve our own objective of self-defense more in Britain's hands than if we kept them here? And can we spare them, taking into consideration the possibility of sudden need? Those are matters of strategy, he said, matters for the general staff. But, said Senator Austin, we ought to seize upon every opportunity to defend ourselves. We are on the defensive as we have never been before. The emergency is great. To the isolationists in Congress, the proposal seems one more step in what they think is a long series leading to involvement. Yet, the voice of isolationism was weak when American destroyers were transferred to Britain. These flying fortresses may also be connected directly or indirectly with a proposal to let the United States share Britain's naval bases in the Far East. Such American access to Singapore would be another gesture to restrain Japan as it penetrates into French Indochina. But to isolationists, any linking of flying fortresses and Far East bases would merely serve to double the liability. The large-scale preparations for handling conscription continue in Washington, although no selective service director has yet been named. Two persons have been mentioned for the command of the draft machinery, Major General Gullion and Lieutenant Colonel Hershey. From Republican quarters in Congress, there comes some muttering over the White House silence on a draft administrator. Representative Ditter, chairman of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, says, after all the pressure and clamor for speed when the measure was before Congress, it seems strange there should be a delay in selecting a man for the administrative job. There's a copy here of the questionnaire which the registrants in the draft have to fill out. The Census Bureau, by the way, says there are 16,404,000 men in the ages 21 to 35 who will be due to register October 16th. The questionnaire runs 8 pages. Your physical condition, your dependents, all the details of your occupation are required. The Selective Service Headquarters is being swamped with questions. They say that although it has been made clear only single men are likely to be taken in the first draft, there are some wives writing in wanting to know how they can keep their husbands out, and others asking how they can get them in.
CBS has brought you reports from its correspondents in London, Berlin, and Washington. This morning, Eric Severide reported from London, William L. Shirer reported from Berlin, while Albert Warner was heard from Washington. George Bryan speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.